Part 2. Self-Help. Chapter 12. Kelsey Castle, Summit Lake. March 8, 2012. Day 4. Her conversation with Millie Mays was the first glimmer of light shed on the dark mystery of Becca Eckersley. Being married opened up a motive and created at least one suspect. That Becca eloped was another avenue she would need to pursue. But first, Kelsey wanted to figure out who this guy was and if he had any reason to kill his new wife. With her mind racing around the fresh developments, Kelsey headed to the Water's Edge restaurant to meet Peter Ambrose and see if he came through with the medical records and autopsy report. She turned down a side street off Maple and found the restaurant on the corner. Peter was already seated at a table by the window and waved when she entered. "Hi," Kelsey said as she walked over.
"Hi,"
Peter said, pointing to the chair across from him. Out of his scrubs now, he wore a blue sport coat over a Ralph Lauren button-down. Kelsey, too, had changed for this dinner meeting into slacks and high heels. She wore a white blouse under a gray blazer and had swiped her eyelashes with mascara and pulled her hair back before leaving the Winchester. "Thanks again for doing this for me, Dr. Ambrose," she said. Peter waved as he sat down.
"Call me Peter, and don't thank me yet."
Had they not been about to discuss a young girl's death, they looked very much like two young professionals on a dinner date. With a sharp, angled jaw and crisp hazel eyes, Peter Ambrose was attractive. And if Kelsey didn't want to admit that she noticed his good looks, she would have to find another reason to explain why she'd applied bronzer and lipstick for the first time in over a month.
"What's wrong? Couldn't find anything?" "No, I found quite a bit, but it wasn't easy. Someone's trying to keep the details of the case quiet."
"Yeah, that's what the police chief told me." Kelsey draped her purse over the back of the chair. "The district attorney's office thinks the Summit Lake police force is without the resources and know-how to handle a homicide, so the state detectives took over up here." She pulled her chair in. "What did you find with the medical records?"
"Getting my hands on this information was not easy, and I wasn't able to get everything you asked for."
"Why was it so hard?"
"The medical records should be easily accessible through our electronic medical records system, but I'll be damned if I didn't have to jump through hoops to find out about the night Becca Eckersley was brought to the ER. Her file was elevated, which means very few people have access to it. No nurses, or any paramedical staff, are able to pull up her file, and very few physicians. I had to dig for a password before I could get to her records."
"Sorry to put you out. I thought you'd just pull a file. I hope I'm not getting you in any trouble." Peter shook his head.
"Everything's electronic now. Pulling a file anymore means looking it up on a computer. And I have the clearance. I've just never had to use it before."
The waitress came over. "Can I start you with a drink?" "Sure." Kelsey looked at the table and saw Peter had a glass of wine in front of him. "I'll have a glass of wine."
"Sauvignon Blanc," Peter said.
The waitress smiled and laughed. "You're a surgeon, right?" Kelsey asked. "I did a little background on you."
"Trained as a surgeon, yes. General surgery. But since taking this job, I feel like I do more administrative work than surgery."
"Are there many surgical cases up here in the mountains? I think with that specialty, you'd want to be in an urban location."
"I was. For a few years, I ran the surgery department at St. Luke's in New York."
"So why are you up here pushing papers?" Kelsey asked. Peter smiled. "Sorry," Kelsey said. "I'm used to interviewing people, so I sometimes have trouble conversing without drilling for information."
"No, it's a good question. But there are cases up here. People have a way of finding you. I was getting burned out in New York. Too many cases, too many hours, too much stress. We're a much smaller operation up here, but the cases we handle are still complicated and challenging. I can concentrate on each patient more closely, without delegating so much off to residents and fellows."
"You have a family?"
"No. Well, a wife."
"How is she adjusting to the move up here?" Peter pursed his lips in a reluctant smile.
"Sorry, ex-wife."
Peter broke eye contact and stared at his wine, grabbed the stem and swirled it. He took a sip.
"Still piecing things together."
The waitress delivered Kelsey's wine and took their dinner orders.
I was offered this job and decided it would be good for me to get out of New York for a while. I know people say otherwise, but no marriage ends well. Sorry, Peter. He smiled again. I'm not the first divorced surgeon the world has ever seen. I'll be okay. Here, let me show you what I found. Peter pulled a thin manila folder from his leather bag. These are the notes from the night the girl was brought to the ER. I printed them out. Peter handed the pages to Kelsey. You can't keep these, but you're welcome to look at them here. Kelsey took the packet and read through the emergency room physician's notes. Help me out here, Kelsey said. Some of it's medical jargon I don't understand. I looked through the records this afternoon, Peter said. The Eckersley girl was brought by ambulance to the ER and arrived at about 10 p.m. Really bad shape. Her biggest problem being a fractured trachea.
Her neck was broken?
Windpipe was crushed. She was strangled.
Kelsey blinked several times as she processed this. Peter continued.
Most deaths from strangulation are caused from asphyxiation. The assailant clamps their hands around a victim's neck hard enough to stop airflow through the windpipe, the trachea. And if this is done long enough, it causes a lack of oxygen to the brain and organs and eventual death. In Becca Eckersley's case, the assailant did this in such a ruthless manner that her trachea collapsed.
Kelsey made an ugly face. That's terrible.
Terribly brutal, yes. And when she arrived at the hospital that night, there was very little the doctors could do. The EMTs had started a tracheotomy, which was the correct measure to take, just too late.
What's that?
A trach. They put a hole in her throat. When they realized her windpipe was fractured, and they weren't able to push air into her lungs through her mouth as they normally would do, the EMTs attempted to intubate, insert a tube into her throat to deliver oxygen to the lungs, but were unable to accomplish this because of the fracture. Instead, they made an incision in her throat below the fracture to gain access to the undamaged segment of the trachea. They administered oxygen through a pump bag. When they arrived at the hospital, she had only a faint pulse. The ER staff continued working on her, had her stabilized for a while, but she was just too far gone. They managed to keep her alive until her parents arrived. She died the next morning.
The waitress delivered their salads, and Kelsey pushed hers aside. Sorry, she smiled at Peter. I'm not hungry anymore.
Probably a bad idea to do this over dinner.
Kelsey shook her head. I didn't know it was this brutal.
Let's take our drinks to the bar. Sound better?
Kelsey crinkled her nose. Much. Peter talked to the waitress and paid for their uneaten dinners. At the bar, they sat on corner stools so they could face each other. Kelsey pulled out her notes again and laid them on the bar. Were you able to talk to any of the medical staff? The ER docs? Peter shook his head.
No, this wasn't my case, and there's no reason for me to get involved, so I don't feel comfortable asking questions. Yet. I need to figure out how to approach my problem.
What problem? Peter took a sip of wine.
The old days of fudging medical records are over, he said. A physician can no longer simply open a patient's file and change a diagnosis, or insert a pertinent finding, or delete something that shouldn't be there, the way he used to. Sometimes weeks later, by jotting it down in ink or crossing it out. Now everything's electronic, and once the record is signed, it's final. In order to change the medical record after it's been officially signed, you need to unsign it, make your changes, and then sign it again. And when this is done, it leaves a trail.
Becca's chart was unsigned?
Twice, Peter said.
What was changed?
That's impossible to tell. I can only see that it was signed the night she was brought to the ER, and then unsigned the day after, and again 2 days later.
But you can't see what was changed?
No, Peter said. And I'm curious because of what I found with the autopsy.
Okay, Kelsey said slowly, mulling over the idea that Becca's medical records could have been altered. She consulted her notes. Becca was brought to the ER and pronounced dead the next morning. When was the autopsy done?
The autopsy was a little trickier, Peter said. Since the girl's death was ruled a homicide, The hospital pathologist here in town didn't perform the autopsy. It was done by the Buchanan County Medical Examiner. Peter pulled more notes from his bag and placed them on the bar. Autopsy was performed the next day by Dr. Michelle Maddox, but I couldn't manage to get a copy of the actual report. It hasn't been released yet. The best I could do was a synopsis of some of the findings. And? Some general external findings, Peter said, running a finger down the page. Confirming strangulation, including petechia to the lids and subconjunctival hemorrhages. Kelsey raised her eyebrows. Bleeding in the whites of the eyes, Peter said. When blood flow is restricted during strangulation, the pressure inside the blood vessels increases. This causes small blood vessels, capillaries, to burst. This is visible in the eyes, and internally also the lungs. Peter looked back to his notes. External exam also noted bruising to the neck, with dramatic soft tissue damage and fractures to the hyoid bone and cricoid cartilage. All common in strangulations. Internal examination of the laryngeal skeleton confirmed the tracheal fracture. Peter turned the page. A tuft of missing hair on the back of her scalp and a large subdural hematoma at the base of her skull. The bastard hit her with something? No, the missing tuft was pulled manually. Based on follicle absence and random patterns of the hair loss, the bleeding is believed to be the result of a fall. Peter shrugged. She stumbled backward, I guess, and hit her head when she landed. He went back to the page. Also, two dislocated knuckles on the victim's right hand. So she went down swinging, Kelsey said, and scratching. There was skin under her fingernails. Peter looked to the notes again. There were also contusions. He paused. I don't know how much you know about this case. I've just started digging, so I know only what I've learned in the last couple of days.
And you didn't know the victim?
No, why?
There were contusions to the victim's vaginal area, indicating rape.
Kelsey slowly sat back on her stool and crossed her arms. I was unaware Becca had been raped.
Sorry to be so blunt.
Kelsey shook her head. It's fine. I was under the impression it was a simple homicide.
I'm not surprised you didn't know about the rape. Not many people do. It's not mentioned in the medical records from the ER, and if it was, it's been removed. And this record here, the report of investigation, as it's called, created by the county medical examiner, is a partial synopsis of the autopsy and is supposed to be public record. So presumably any reporter should be able to talk to the medical examiner or pathologist to get a copy of this.
But
the county hasn't released it yet.
Kelsey made some notes. Not unreasonable. They have 6 weeks, right?
They do. But I managed to get my hands on the official synopsis that's set for release, and it doesn't include the assumption of rape.
Kelsey cocked her head. The report of investigation that will be released is different from the one you found?
Exactly, Peter said.
So how did you get this copy?
I've got a contact at the Buchanan County Government Center. He did me a favor.
Why would they be hiding that Becca was raped?
Not sure. Probably just delaying the information until they get a better handle on the investigation. But the report of investigation is always the first document released. Then the ME is allowed to release an amended version some weeks later. Then the final, formal autopsy report after that, which includes definitive cause of death and toxicology reports.
I've been there before, Kelsey said. Later means when no one's looking any longer.
No reporters anyway, Peter said.
We never stop looking, but the public loses interest. And that's what they want. She remembered her conversation with Commander Ferguson about Becca's father running for a spot on the bench. That his only daughter had secretly married and was then raped is something he might want to keep from his constituents. Kelsey went back to her notes and scribbled for a minute. According to the synopsis you have there, did they find anything on the body?
Yes, Peter said. Semen, hair, skin cells. Dr. Maddox believes some of the hair was from a beard.
How can she determine that?
Some of the hair specimens contain the bulb or root, suggesting they were pulled out during the struggle. Some were long, and they were determined to be from the perpetrator's scalp. Others were short. Based on their length and the fact that they had full shafts connected to the root, they were determined to come from facial hair. Kelsey made notes about long hair and beards while Peter talked. "Also fibers," Peter said, "presumably from a wool coat." "So the attack happened shortly after he entered the Stilt house?"
"Yeah," Peter said. "Never took off his coat."
"So found on the body was everything they need for a conviction?"
"From the fluid and hair recovery, it would be an easy DNA match, yes."
"If they had anyone to match it to," Kelsey said. She went back to her notes and studied them for a minute. "Ever heard of a protective father suppressing information?"
"You mean about this being a rape?"
"Yeah."
"You'd have to be quite powerful to do that, and very connected on top of it."
"William Eckersley is both. A big-time lawyer who's gearing up to be a judge. He has both money and political clout."
"I don't doubt it. Clearance on the electronic medical records has been elevated, and the records themselves have been changed, or at least reopened. Filing of the autopsy synopsis report will be abbreviated, and the full autopsy report is out there somewhere, and sure to be very delayed."
"Out there where?"
"Don't know. But Dr. Maddox would know, and probably the state detectives also."
"What are the chances I could get my hands on that full report?" Peter smiled.
"Not very good."
Kelsey shook her head. "I'd love to see it."
"So would I, now that I know something's up."
Kelsey felt an adrenaline rush. She always did when she knew a story had some bite. "Your friend who helped you get the report of investigation synopsis, you think he could help with the actual autopsy?" Peter thought for a moment.
"I doubt he'd want to get involved with stealing an autopsy report." He shrugged. "I'll ask around and see what I can do."
"Thanks for all your help." Kelsey packed up her things and stuffed them in her purse. "It's been eye-opening."
"Keep me posted on what you find. Now I'm curious."
"You too," Kelsey said. It was close to 10 p.m. when she made it back to the Winchester. She called Penn Courtney and left a message. His plan of sequestering her up in the mountains to chase a story that didn't exist had been foiled, she explained to his voicemail. She'd stumbled onto something here in Summit Lake, and her investigational radar told her it was something interesting. She hung up the phone and spent the rest of the night poring through her notes and rereading the new information she gathered about Becca Eckersley. A story was forming in her mind. It was too early to see the entire arc, but she'd been through the process before. From nothing, a small narrative was taking form about Becca Eckersley's life and death. There were many gaps in the story and hundreds of unanswered questions, but the process was working, and Kelsey knew, like a train moving downhill, there was no stopping this story from making it to the page. She took her computer and notes to the balcony. The night air was cool, and it helped clear her mind. The Winchester Hotel stood at the north end of Maple Street, and from her third-story balcony, Kelsey's view spanned through town to St. Patrick's Church on the south end, whose facade was lighted by upward-shooting spotlights that broke through the dark night and illuminated the bleached white stone in V-shaped cascades. Lamp posts stood on all four corners of intersections and brightened the streets. The maple trees running down the middle island were budding with early spring, and the street was littered with old leaves from fall. A lake breeze swept across town and stirred them in funnels. To the east, Kelsey saw the lighthouse, sitting on a point somewhere on the other side of the water, its powerful light cutting through the darkness. Her gaze moved to the stilt houses running into the shallow water of Summit Lake. She stared at the Eckersley home for a while, thinking of Becca and all she went through in that house. A sanctuary, warm and safe, turned into hell. Kelsey pulled out Commander Ferguson's file and riffled through the pages. She found the inventory list itemizing the evidence collected at the Eckersley's home the night Becca was killed. The list was long and tortuous to read. It included such items as E1, Constitutional Law Textbook, open on kitchen floor. E2, Apple MacBook, open, face down on kitchen floor, screen cracked. E3, 5 notebook pages scattered on kitchen floor, handwritten study notes. E4, iPod and speakers. E5, One heavy sock, slipper in living room. Size, small. The list went on for 2 pages. A tedium of items written in a man's ugly chicken scratch. Kelsey was so interested she read the list twice to make sure. Nowhere on the pages was there mention of a journal. Without being aware of the passing hours, Kelsey noticed it was approaching midnight. She was suddenly cold and tired. She packed up her research and carried her laptop inside where she climbed under the covers. As she drifted off, she was restless, tossing and turning as her mind worked. When she finally made it to sleep, a vivid dream placed her inside Becca Eckersley's home. She walked through the kitchen. Floated, really. It took no effort at all. On the kitchen island was a textbook and notes and an open computer, but something else, too. A hard-covered binder, small and compact. Becca's journal? Yes, of course. Kelsey reached for it, hoping to page through it and find the answers to all her questions, but her movements were congested, and the harder she tried, the farther away she floated. Finally, there were 3 loud knocks on the mudroom door. She floated to the door, pulling it open to reveal Becca's killer, but she found only darkness outside. Then something. A flash of light from the lakeside of the house. Kelsey ran to the patio deck and saw the lighthouse across the lake. Then she heard the pounding of feet as someone ran along the dock. When she turned, she saw Peter Ambrose jogging up the dock and into the night. When she looked back to the house, a faceless man was standing in the shadows. She tried to scream, but could only manage to exhale heavily. Then she ran. The slow gallop of running through knee-high water. She was back in Miami now, attempting to run along her jogging path. The path by the water she took each morning. The path through the woods, where her life had gone to hell. She felt his presence and tried to move faster. In a flash, he came at her from the woods, crunching over twigs and leaves. Her breathing became erratic, hyperventilating just as the man grabbed her. It was enough to startle her awake. She sat up in bed, her lungs frantic, as if she'd actually been running, her thumping heart so palpable she heard it in her ears. An every night occurrence at first, the dreams had subsided of late, absent from her entire time in Summit Lake. Until tonight. Until she discovered Becca was raped. Now, her nightmare stomped on the muddy bottom and clouded Kelsey's mind with all the fears from that morning in the woods she'd been working so hard to settle. Kelsey spent that first month inside her home. She hadn't been beyond her locked door but for a few times before she forced herself back to the office, knowing if she stayed in her house any longer, she might never leave. Healing might come with time, as the doctors told her, but the longer she waited, the more far off recovery felt. Closure would only come, Kelsey knew, when she decided to chase it. And learning about Becca's rape brought her own ordeal back, dangled it in front of her nose, and dared her to go after it. Hearing the details from Peter, the first man other than Penn whom she'd spoken to in weeks, added to her angst. She lay back down, the pillow absorbing her head, and closed her eyes. Sleep never came. Chapter 13. Becca Eckersley, Summit Lake, December 22, 2010, 14 months before her death. The flight from D.C. to Charlotte was smooth and quiet. Becca slept with her head on Jack's shoulder, while Jack's mind worked on the idea that his best friend was in love with his girlfriend. They may have been able to conquer the secrecy of their relationship had they come clean last summer when everyone returned for senior year. But now, Jack knew, months later, and with this new revelation about Brad, their relationship would be much harder to explain. Becca's parents met them at arrivals, and they threw their bags in the back of the Escalade. Jack stood in the background while Becca hugged her parents. "Mom and Dad," Becca said, giddy with excitement. "This is Jack." "Hi, Jack," Becca's mom said as she hugged him. Jack shook Mr. Eckersley's hand, and they all climbed into the Escalade.
"Thanks for having me for Christmas," Jack said as they pulled away.
"You're very welcome," Mrs. Eckersley said.
"So, Jack," Mr. Eckersley said,
Becca tells us you're looking at some very impressive law schools. Same ones as Becca, mostly.
He's already heard from Stanford, Becca said, looking at Jack and smiling with those perfect teeth.
Is that right?
Jack nodded in the back seat while he gave Becca a dirty look. His acceptance to Stanford was something he told only Becca, but no one else. He hadn't even told his own parents yet, and he definitely didn't want to discuss law school during this trip. He knew William Eckersley was a mega lawyer with his own power firm and was rumored to be heading for the bench. Having no real interest in the profession, Jack wanted to avoid law talk altogether. He had no intention of slogging to work every day in a stiff suit, trying to outperform the other stiff suits who were trying to outperform him.
Yeah, I just heard last week.
Early, Mr. Eckersley said.
They offer a few early admissions to some of their top prospects, Becca said.
That's not exactly true, Jack said. You have to have... I just had a good recommendation.
From Senator Ward of Maryland, who Jack worked for over the summer. He's a Stanford alum.
Well, congratulations, Mrs. Eckersley said. Are you taking the offer?
I'm not sure about California.
He doesn't get excited about it because he doesn't even want to be a lawyer. He wants to write, Becca said.
Write what?
Mr. Eckersley asked. Jack widened his eyes at Becca. They agreed not to talk about any of this with her parents. His counselor already told him his career choice was suicide, and that if he got into a top-notch law school, he should work hard and take a big firm job after graduation. His counselor pulled out graphs of the salary projections for Ivy League law graduates and told Jack exactly how much he should be earning in 5 years. Trying to be a speechwriter was wildly risky, his counselor told him. He went on for 15 minutes about other kids who missed opportunities and where they were now in life. Jack wanted to ask which opportunity his counselor missed along the way that stuck him now in a 10x10 office pushing papers and steering persuadable kids away from their dreams.
Political speeches, maybe, Jack said. Becca and the rest of our friends are going to law school also, so I'm sure one of them will end up in Congress. Maybe they'll hire me.
He smiled at Becca. Brad's the only one who wants to run for office. Gail and I will open our own practice and be millionaires before 30.
Keep talking like that, and you'll give me a heart attack, Mr. Eckersley said.
Don't worry, Daddy. I'll add the third Eckersley to the firm's name.
So where does this aspiration for political speech writing come from?
Mr. Eckersley asked Jack.
I interned for a couple of summers back in Wisconsin for the governor's campaign, and had the opportunity to write a bit here and there, and then the last 3 summers at a program on Capitol Hill.
He wrote the draft for Senator Ward when he addressed Congress about military spending, Becca said.
Really?
Mrs. Eckersley said. Milt Ward? Jack nodded.
You wrote his speech.
Me and the rest of the interns, Jack clarified, and most of my stuff got cut out.
You always do that, Becca said. I hate when you put yourself down. Jack laughed.
That's not a put down, it's a fact. My part was on defense spending, and most of it got cut.
Only because of time restraints. Becca leaned forward between the seats so her parents could hear clearly. The senator called Jack later to tell him he had more promise than any of the other interns. Becca's mom turned in the passenger seat.
Really?
I think it was a courtesy call, Jack said. He sponsored the program, so I imagine he called all the interns and said something similar.
Becca shook her head as she leaned back. He did not call the other interns. Sammy Ahern was in the same program, and she never got a call from Ward. That's just you being modest. Senator Ward wrote 1 recommendation letter this year, even though 100 students probably asked him. It went to Jack.
So why law school if you want to write speeches? Mr. Eckersley asked. I'll intern during the summers and get some more experience, and law school will be a good resume booster. I guess it'll make me more legit if I write about policy stuff. Well, the law is a fascinating occupation, and maybe you'll change your mind when you start school. Either way, it sounds like you've got your head screwed on straight.
William Eckersley turned his head to look back at Becca while he drove.
So I'm finally piecing together why you were so adamant about staying in D.C. last summer instead of clerking for me. Is this official now? You two are dating?
No one at school knows, Becca said, but we're telling everyone when we get back. An acidic gas bubble burst somewhere in Jack's esophagus, causing instant heartburn. He stifled the belch and faked a smile to Becca. Mr. Eckersley changed his focus to the rearview mirror, where he could see his daughter's face.
And why the secrecy about you guys dating?
I already told you, Daddy. We're all friends, and we just want to wait to tell everyone.
Wait for what, honey?
We're waiting for the right time, Dad. It's just one of those situations you're not going to understand.
Ah, of course. But remember, you were 3 years old before your mother and I told anyone about you, so I might understand more than you think.
You're such a dork, Dad. They drove in silence for 10 minutes before Mr. Eckersley spoke.
Jack, are you familiar with the Blue Ridge Mountains?
Not so much, Jack said. I'm from Wisconsin, so mountains are a new phenomenon to me.
They're part of the Great Smoky Mountain Range. They are sort of the interior of the Appalachians and formed a barrier to the original settlers. Not until late in the 1700s.
Dad, we just finished finals. We don't need a history lesson.
It's not a lesson. It's interesting background on where we're headed. Anyway, we have a home up in the mountains where we like to spend Christmas each year. It's a lake home, and we also spend quite a bit of time up there in the summer. I used to like to run my Catalina around the lake, until Becca decided she was the new captain. I only take orders now. The town is called Summit Lake, Mr. Eckersley said.
Becca told me about your house. It sits on the water, right? On stilts or something?
If you fell off the porch, you'd land in the lake, Becca said.
A stilt house, Jack said.
I'm really excited to see it.
Becca's brother was engaged to a girl whose parents lived in Manhattan, so he was spending his Christmas in New York. And being a newly minted member of his father's law office, he was flying back to Greensboro on Christmas night to be in the office on the 26th. That made Jack, Becca, and her parents the only participants in the Eckersley's holiday trek to Summit Lake. The same pressures of making her mark were coming for Becca when she joined her father's firm, but she'd have to tackle law school first before she joined the other gunners who thought 90 hours a week was the only way to prove their worth. It was approaching 6 p.m. when they pulled into Summit Lake. Even without daylight, Becca and Jack could sense the mountains staring down on them.
See, look, Becca said as they came into town. She pointed to the lake where two rows of 10 houses ran into the water, supported by long pillars.
Decorated in Christmas lights, the houses were ablaze and reflected off the lake below. A narrow road ran behind the houses, and Mr. Eckersley steered the Escalade along the path. He parked in a small spot next to the last house in the line. They all piled out. It was chillier here than at sea level. Becca took Jack by the hand and led him to the deck that ran 360 degrees around the house. They walked to the back of the house, where they looked out at the lake.
What do you think?
This is amazing. Now I know why you love it so much. What's out there?
Jack asked, as he stared at a light on the other side of the lake.
The Summit Lake Lighthouse. On Christmas night, it alternates red and green. It sits on the point right where the mountains end. On the other side, the lake opens up for many miles.
She excitedly turned him in the other direction and pointed at the town. See the tree? Over the two-story buildings, Jack saw the top of a pine tree glowing with colored lights and a bright star. Becca squeezed his hand, reading his mind the way she always did.
Don't get sad. We're going to Green Bay next year for Christmas.
I know. I can just see my mom crying Christmas morning when I'm not there.
Next year, my mom will be doing the same thing. When I'm 30 years old, she'll still cry if I'm not around on Christmas morning.
They unpacked the car and then headed into town. Becca carried a wrapped box containing the latest Rage doll, while Jack carried a Tonka truck. They walked along the dock that ran behind the stilt houses and then onto Maple Street, which was 5 blocks long and concluded with a 3-story hotel at the end. Shops and restaurants lined the road, and in the middle of town they came to the giant pine that would not have been misplaced in Rockefeller Center. They each put their donation underneath it.
Come on, Becca said. I want to show you the town.
They headed to the end of Maple Street, turned around and walked back on the other side. Foot traffic was sporadic as people strolled in and out of shops grabbing gifts a few days before Christmas. Without the intrusion of city lights, the night sky was decorated with stars. It reminded Jack of home. He stared off at the houses that ran up the mountain. They were alive with Christmas decorations, and he imagined a life where a second home waited in the mountains, where family and friends gathered for long weekends and holidays. He got to know wealthy kids since he started at George Washington, some so rich they made his life back in Green Bay look like a page out of National Geographic. Becca and her family, he knew, approached this type of wealth. His own family never had much money and could never afford a vacation house up in Door County, where some of his friends went during the summer. But none of that ever mattered to him. His parents gave him and his sisters everything they had, and from that, Jack was able to attend GWU. Maybe from that opportunity, a life like the one Becca had lived for 20 years might be possible. Maybe. For the first time, doubt crept into his mind and stained the way he thought about his future. As he stood in this town, he was nervous about what he would have to offer the girl he loved. Was his counselor correct in his guidance? Jack thought of 90-hour work weeks, digging through research in the basement of a New York firm. No, he decided. He'd crash and burn and live off food stamps before he gave up on his dreams, or fell into the rut of a 9-to-5 life, or 5-to-9 life, as many first-year graduates in New York live. "That's our church," Becca said, pointing to the large structure at the end of Maple Street. "They have a really pretty service for midnight mass." Jack smiled. "I can't wait." "Are you glad you came?"
"I am."
Becca wrapped her arm around his waist as they walked through town. He lifted his arm around her shoulder and pulled her close. Chapter 14. Kelsey Castle, Summit Lake, March 9th, 2012. Day 5. She woke early and took to the streets in a slow jog. Despite her dream, or perhaps because of it, she was determined to run this morning. The town was asleep at 5:30 a.m. as Kelsey snaked her way along the sidewalks and through the avenues until she reached the lake. A dirt path took her past the hospital and around the water to the Summit Lake Lighthouse 2 miles away. A paved path led through the courtyard to the entryway of the lighthouse tower. She climbed the stairs, spiral metal planks that clinked under her shoes. 40-watt bulbs offered dim resistance to the darkness outside. She was breathing heavy when she made it to the top and exited from the small doorway that felt like it belonged on a submarine. The breeze was stronger at the top of the tower, and Kelsey grabbed the railing to steady herself. She looked across the lake. The town was just starting to rise now, with lights visible in scattered homes and chimneys twisting smoke into the morning. She walked around to the other side of the tower, where the lake opened up to a vast expanse of water that covered many miles. From her perspective, she could see the horizon burning with pre-dawn. The metal grating was cold as she sat down and slipped her legs between the railings, dangling her feet over the side. Hugging the two railing bars, Kelsey stuck her face between them and watched the sunrise. When the sun peeked over the horizon and painted a highway along the surface of Summit Lake, Kelsey's mind settled on Becca Eckersley. If Kelsey's information was correct and Becca had married in secret, why? The list of possibilities was long. Becca's parents did not approve of the guy. Their relationship was new, and they were young, and no one would understand getting married so soon. He was older, a professor perhaps, or maybe an attorney, and their affair had to be kept quiet. Despite the reason, the result was the same. Becca's parents knew nothing about the marriage, or at least they didn't the night she was killed. Kelsey shifted her gaze across the lake. The arc of the stilt houses was visible. At the end, the Eckersley home caught the morning light. Kelsey pursed her lips and exhaled a long, slow breath that was scantily visible in the cool air. She needed Becca's journal. If it existed, it surely held the identity of the man she married. And if Becca did write in it at the coffee house the night she was killed, someone knew about this journal. Kelsey spent 30 minutes on top of the lighthouse, mulling over the facts of Becca's murder and piecing together her information. Finally,
With the sun over the horizon, she headed down the stairs and jogged back around the lake. He offered to meet her at 7 a.m., and it was just a few minutes past when Kelsey finished her jog and slowed her pace. She walked onto the dock next to the stilt houses and spotted him at the far end of the pier. She cooled down as she walked the length of the dock and stopped in front of the Eckersley's home. Commander Ferguson approached her, stuck a cigarette between his lips, and lit the end of it, pulling for a few seconds before talking.
"Good morning, young lady."
Smoke leaked from his mouth and rode away on the lake breeze.
"Looks like you've had a hell of a day already."
"Early jog. I didn't sleep well." Kelsey pointed to the Eckersley's house. "Thanks for doing this."
"Not sure what you're going to learn from going inside, but let's do it before anyone in this town wakes up and sees me letting a reporter into a crime scene."
They bypassed the yellow tape that encircled the deck and flapped in the breeze. Commander Ferguson rattled some keys and fidgeted with the patio doors. He pulled the sliding glass door to the side and Kelsey followed him inside. She walked through the living room and into the large kitchen where, she knew, Becca was assaulted. Kelsey had been here in her dreams the night before. She looked around now and saw a long island with four stools. Pinewood cabinets reached the ceiling. Stainless steel appliances and granite countertops gave the place a polished look. She noticed the doorway off the kitchen that led into a mudroom, the door the attacker entered the night Becca was killed. She imagined that night. Becca's law school material spread across the island as she sat on the stool. Somehow, the man entered the house, either walked straight in through an unlocked door or was allowed in by Becca. Then, a struggle. Becca's knuckles were bruised, and two of them on her right hand broken. Skin beneath her fingernails and facial hair stuck in her palms. Papers and textbooks strewn across the kitchen, and dishes shattered on the ground. As she ran the scene through her mind, Kelsey found herself tensing and rooting for Becca to fight harder, to somehow change the outcome. The fight happened right here, where Kelsey stood. The remnants of that night, the broken dishes and upended furniture, were still present. An eerie feeling came over her as Kelsey considered she was standing in the same place another woman had been assaulted, something Kelsey went through just weeks before. Pulled from her jogging trail that morning, Kelsey fought for her life the same as Becca. And the questions Kelsey was asking of Becca and her life were the same ones that lurked in the dark corners of her own mind. Questions about why she was attacked, and if there was something she did to cause it. If she could have done anything different that morning to prevent it. Questions about why the bastard picked her and not someone else. About how long he had waited for her, and watched her. And whether she knew the man behind the mask, or if he was just a random stranger choosing a random woman. Walking through the Eckersley's home caused these dark corners of her mind to shine brightly, and all the questions she was avoiding came sharply into focus. And she wondered now if Penn Courtney, her surrogate father, knew more than he was letting on about Becca's case. If he knew the only way for Kelsey to conquer her fears was to do so through work and with a case that forced her to look long and hard at herself and what had happened. But whether she was giving Penn more credit than he deserved, one thing was certain. There was a reason Kelsey took so quickly to this story, and as she stood in the very spot where Becca Eckersley had been raped and murdered, she realized it. Kelsey felt connected to Becca. There was a sense of knowing exactly what she went through, knowing how she felt that night. As she stood amidst the crime scene, Kelsey knew she wasn't simply writing an article to fill the quota of pages for her monthly grind. She was searching for answers, to return some dignity to an innocent girl who never had a chance at closure. Becca Eckersley deserved a conclusion to this ordeal, and if Kelsey could find those answers and provide that conclusion, maybe she would benefit as much as Becca. Perhaps she could go back to her life and set a course on doing the same thing for herself. Commander Ferguson took 10 minutes to describe the scene from that night. Small details Kelsey scribbled on her notepad, information that alone would never solve anything, but pieced together with what she already knew, added to the narrative. "Mind if I look around?" she asked.
"Place has been cleared out. What are you hoping to find?"
"Insight," Kelsey smiled.
You've got 5 minutes, and don't touch anything.
Commander Ferguson sat on a kitchen stool and drummed his fingers on the granite. Knowing the kitchen was the main crime scene, and all evidence would have been carefully gathered from there, she walked down a hallway and into the den. A desk and chair and a wall of bookshelves made up the room. Unlike the kitchen and family room, this room was immaculate and untouched. Against orders, she quietly pulled open drawers and fingered the contents of the shelves. Upstairs next, Kelsey entered each of the 3 bedrooms. She spent the most time in Becca's room. She checked the nightstand first, then under the mattress. The closet was mostly empty, and the armoire filled with nothing of value. After 5 minutes, she brushed a stray hair from her face while she looked around Becca's bedroom. The quiet room of a dead girl who would never again use any of the things that sat on her dresser, or in her drawers, or on her shelves. Finally, Kelsey headed downstairs.
"Find what you were looking for?"
Commander Ferguson asked as she entered the kitchen. "Nope."
"Did you make a mess while you were slamming drawers and opening closets I told you not to touch?"
"Nope, again."
"Let's get out of here before I lose my job."
They headed back outside and Commander Ferguson locked up the house. They walked down the pier.
"Okay, young lady, what's this news you have to tell me?"
"I know Becca's secret," Kelsey said as they walked. Commander Ferguson sucked again on his cigarette as his eyebrows rose. With his index and middle fingers, he pulled the cigarette from his lips and turned his palm face up.
"Let's hear it."
"She eloped. Ran off and got married without her parents knowing about it." Another pull while the commander considered this. He looked off to the mountains, and Kelsey could tell his mind was working. This was a detective who had an unsolved case that spoke daily to him, begging him to solve it. When he pulled the cigarette from his mouth, smoke rose over his upper lip and into his nostrils. Kelsey thought this might be a new definition for secondhand smoke, and she wanted to mention to the great detective that if the initial puff didn't kill him, taking it in a second time just might. Instead, she waved the odor away from her face. This brought the commander back from his thoughts.
"Sorry about that."
He quickly snuffed the cigarette on the bottom of his shoe and shoved it in his pocket. He waved away the residual smoke, but his mind was clearly elsewhere.
"That doesn't make any sense," he finally said.
"What's that?"
"Becca being married. I looked into her past pretty deep. Never came across any record that suggested such a thing. To get married, you need a marriage license. After the wedding ceremony, a marriage certificate is issued. It must be filed with a county to make the marriage legal. It's part of our great bureaucracy, which is to say it's nothing more than a moneymaker for the counties, but still required by law. I never found any such record."
Kelsey thought about that. They walked down Maple Street until they reached Minnehaha Avenue, then stopped in front of the Summit Lake Police Headquarters. Could Millie Mays have been mistaken? Did the old lady misunderstand her daughter's description of her conversation with Becca? Had a touch of dementia and embellishment grown the story in Millie's mind? Possibly, Kelsey thought, but unlikely. Kelsey had interviewed thousands of sources in the same fashion she did Millie, casually, without pressure to get detailed information, and Kelsey had a feel for when people were stretching what they knew. Sometimes people embellished their knowledge to feel more important and maybe get their name in a magazine. Other times people had no real clue about what Kelsey was asking and couldn't bring themselves to admit it, so they created a story out of nothing. Millie fell into neither of these categories. She was reluctant to divulge the secret she kept, and surely wouldn't have given up any information had Kelsey not manipulated her. "What if they ran off to Vegas and got married on a whim?" she asked. Commander Ferguson shook his head.
"Doesn't matter if it's Vegas or Jamaica. You have to file a marriage certificate. And it would have shown up when we ran her through our national database. If this supposed marriage happened outside the U.S., the certificate would have to route through the U.S. embassy in the foreign country before arriving back here in the States. But it would still get here, maybe a few weeks later. So the argument could be that it's still out there being processed. Problem with that theory is that there's no record of Becca leaving the country. So if she got married, it was right here in the U.S. of A., and there's no record of it. So she either bucked the system, or you're wrong, Miss Castle.
Commander Ferguson brushed his hand over his goatee.
Where'd you get this idea about Becca being married anyway?
Kelsey gave him a smile, as if he should know better than to ask such a question.
Fine, he said. How credible is this person?
If the marriage angle is true, she's very credible. I guess we'll have to dig a little for the answer. The commander pulled a stubbed cigarette from his pocket and brought it back to life. He took extra care to keep the smoke to himself.
Only way that scenario is possible would be if they got married on the sly, real quick, without anybody knowing, then never filed the marriage certificate, which they'd have to do together.
So maybe Becca was killed before they filed? Commander Ferguson pointed his cigarette at her.
Exactly. That's the only way.
They both stood in silence for a while. I've looked very carefully through the information you gave me, Kelsey finally said.
So have I.
Do you know anything about Becca keeping a journal?
What sort of journal?
You know, a diary. The commander shook his head.
Never heard she did. Why? She kept one?
So I've heard.
Where is it? Her parents?
Doubt it, Kelsey said. Supposedly she was writing in it just hours before she was killed. It should have been in the evidence collected that night from the Stilt house.
There was no journal found that night.
I know.
And you're saying there should have been?
I'm saying that if Becca was writing in a journal while she was here in Summit Lake, it has to be somewhere.
And I assume it wasn't in any of the drawers or cabinets you were just banging around back of the Eckersleys.
Kelsey shook her head. Who collected the evidence that night? Created that evidence list?
My guys, Commander Ferguson said. Under my supervision.
Not your state friends?
They didn't arrive until late that night, after most of the evidence was documented. If a diary was in that house, we'd have found it.
And documented it?
Of course.
Kelsey closed her eyes and rubbed her temples.
Still doesn't help us much, the commander said, even if it's true about Becca being married.
Kelsey cocked her head to the side. No, you told me to find Becca's secret.
I did,
Commander Ferguson said as he sucked the life from the cigarette.
But finding a secret is never the key. Figuring out why a secret is a secret.
He lifted his cigarette into the air.
That will lead you somewhere.
Chapter 15. Becca Eckersley, Summit Lake, December 28, 2010, 14 months before her death. They spent 3 days after Christmas in Summit Lake. Becca and Jack walked the town, drank coffee at Millie's coffee house, ate dinners with Becca's parents, and spent quiet nights at the Stilt house watching movies and playing cards. Mr. Eckersley tried to impress on Jack the wonders of practicing law instead of simply possessing a law degree. Jack promised not to make any decisions until he finished school. On their last night, Jack and Becca went to dinner alone. This summer, Becca said, you'll have to come to Greensboro so I can show you where I live. We'll drive to the coast and watch the waves roll in from the Caribbean. Maybe after law school, we'll take a vacation there.
Where?
The Caribbean. St. Lucia or St. Thomas. Or maybe we'll charter a sailboat and cruise around the British Virgin Islands.
I don't know how to sail.
I'll teach you this summer. I'll take you to Mumford Cove where we keep our Catalina. It's right on the coast.
Great idea, Jack said. So a Catalina is a sailboat?
Becca smiled. Yes.
I don't speak the same language as you. We never had a boat in my family.
So what? It doesn't take long to learn to sail.
What are you going to do after law school? Jack asked.
What do you mean?
I mean, look at your life here. You go to a very expensive college, and so do I, but I have a full ride. I assume your parents write a check each semester. You've got a vacation home in the mountains,
A huge house in Greensboro. And a Catalina. Two of them, right? One back home and one up here.
So, we also have a house in Vail. What does it matter?
If you saw my life in Wisconsin, and I don't mean this in a bad way because I'm not ashamed of it, but if you saw where I lived, the house I grew up in, the car we drive, I think you'd see a very different life than all this.
What does that have to do with what I'm going to do after law school?
First-year lawyers don't exactly kill it, unless you go to New York and sell yourself as a slave to a big firm. But I know that's not what you want to do. And your dad is smart enough not to bring his little girl into the firm a few years after he brought in his son and throw a huge salary at her before she proves herself.
So I get an apartment and drive a used car and eat cheap meals. You don't think I can do that?
I think you can do it. It's just that for me, I'm used to it.
But we'll be together, so it doesn't matter where we live or what we have. Becca smiled. You're enough for me. But I have news for you, Jack. You're going to be quite successful in whatever you do. He shrugged.
I guess we both have to get through one more semester of college, and then law school before we worry about any of that.
It's so weird, isn't it? Becca said. Thinking about life after college. No more running around, no more hiding things. We can get our own place and actually sleep together all night. No more sneaking home in the middle of the night. It's going to be weird telling Gail and Brad, but I think Gail suspects something anyway.
Yeah,
Jack said as he stared out the window of the restaurant.
Gonna be real weird. Becca Eckersley.
The voice was deep and practiced, and when Jack looked up, he was surprised to see someone his age attached to it. The guy wore a trying way too hard beard that was meticulously maintained, and of which he was obviously very proud. Hi, Becca said, shooting a quick glance at Jack. Her eyes widened briefly, a little thing she did to let Jack know something awkward was happening. Becca stood up and offered the guy an obligatory hug. What are you doing up here? She asked.
Home from school and here with my parents. How's GW?
Good, Becca said. Really, really good. How about Harvard?
It is what it's supposed to be. A stepping stone, right? Everything's kosher.
Jack saw her wipe her hands on her skirt. Another one of her tells. This is Jack, Becca said. Jack stood. He was a few inches taller and significantly wider than the guy in front of him. He offered his hand. The guy grabbed it and shook hard. The alpha male.
Richard Walker. Becca and I are old friends, he said,
like they were 40 years old and on a two-decade sabbatical. Richard and I went to high school together, Becca said.
Yeah, the guy said. We dated.
He looked at Jack.
We were what they call high school sweethearts.
Jack kept his gaze on Richard and offered an expressionless face.
I'm familiar with the term.
Jack was also now familiar with Richard Walker. This was the idiot who stopped by school every so often to upset Becca and make her cry. When Jack and Becca first met, she was untying the dating knot that snared these two throughout high school. 4 years later, she was still working at it. Jack remembered Becca's red-rimmed eyes during finals week when this jackass stopped by to again pledge his love for her and explain how broken-hearted he was without her. Jack also recalled from his discussions with Becca that this guy's family owned a house here in Summit Lake, where the two spent every summer during high school.
You've been in town for a while? Richard asked.
About a week. We came up for Christmas, leaving tomorrow.
You both came up.
Becca nodded.
How do you guys know each other?
Richard asked. We go to school together, Becca said.
We're what they call college sweethearts, Jack said.
Richard's face froze for a second. Then a forced smile appeared, and Jack could tell instantly this guy was full of himself and shit.
Gotcha. Good for you guys. Where are you from, Chief?
Chief?
Green Bay. Wisconsin?
Richard made a strange face.
The sticks, huh? Welcome to civilization.
Jack stared at him but said nothing. Richard broke away and looked at Becca again.
Can I talk to you a minute?
Becca's eyebrows rose.
Sure.
In private?
Becca smiled awkwardly, looked quickly at Jack and then back to Richard. I'm out to dinner, Richard, so I'm not going to run in the corner with you like we're in high school.
Jack laughed under his breath. He loved this girl for a reason.
Gotcha,
Richard said again.
Didn't mean to intrude. It was really nice seeing you.
You too, Becca said, as she gave a reluctant hug.
Take it easy, Chief.
See you, Dick, Jack said.
What's that?
Dick.
It's short for Richard. I just go by Richard.
Jack sat down and pulled his napkin over his lap.
See you, Richard.
The forced smile came back to Richard's face.
Really classy, Becca. I'm sure your dad's happier running around with this guy.
Bye, Richard, Becca said. Have a good New Year's.
Richard stared at Becca. Finally, he took a step backward.
Yeah.
Jack watched him leave.
What's Paul Bunyan's problem?
I don't know, Becca said. God, that was awkward.
Has he always talked like that? With that fake broadcaster's voice?
Becca shrugged. He wants to litigate. I guess he thinks it will help.
It'll help the jury think he's an idiot.
Jack looked at Becca.
And you used to date that guy? That's the guy?
She smiled. Stop.
He seems a little off, no?
Jack asked. Yeah, he did look a little strange. He's still, you know, he's never really gotten over us.
You think?
Jack said. Did you call him Dick?
By accident.
Becca shook her head. What am I going to do with you? They finished dinner and walked down Maple Street on the way back to the Stilt house. My parents love you, by the way. Don't worry about Richard. He was trying to get under your skin.
I may not become the lawyer your dad wants you to marry, but compared to Dick Walker, I'm certain your parents think I'm a real catch. Unless your parents fell for that fake smile I almost wiped off his face.
My dad always liked him in high school, but only because I was dating him. Richard's dad is a big trial lawyer, so my dad knows him. Richard used to play that angle. But that's enough about high school. We'll see who we run into next year when we visit your parents.
Jack laughed.
I have no Dick Walkers in my closet, trust me.
Well, Richard was our coming out party. He's the first person we've told about us dating, besides our parents. What's our plan for when we get back to school? We're telling everyone, right? Gail and Brad?
Jack shrugged. Yeah.
You don't seem so sure, Becca said as they walked.
I think we need to talk about it.
About what? He looked at her.
I think we're going to have some issues when we get back to school.
What kind of issues? You're starting to get me worried.
Not issues between you and me. Issues with our friends. We've been keeping this whole thing a secret for so long, it's sort of become scandalous. I'm starting to think we should have just come clean from the beginning, last summer, when everything happened between us. It would have saved us from a bunch of trouble we're about to run into.
They turned onto a side street and headed east toward the lake. I know what you're saying, Becca said, but I think everything will be okay. Maybe a little weird at first, but that's about it.
Gail is one thing, Jack said, as they started along the dock in front of the Eckersley's house. Brad is another.
What do you mean? Jack didn't have time to answer. As he and Becca made their way along the dock, they saw Brad sitting on the bench on Becca's patio. Confusion shaped his face as Brad saw Becca approach with Jack. Brad? Becca said, as a slow smile formed on her face, not understanding what was happening. Oh my God! What do you guys have going on? She smiled at Jack. Did you know about this?
Shit,
Jack said, letting go of Becca's hand. Becca walked closer to Brad and tried to give him a hug. Brad held away her advance with a straight arm, staring only at Jack.
Did you tell her?
He asked.
No, Jack said. I haven't said a word about anything.
Brad? Becca said. What's going on? Her smile faded. What's wrong? Brad stared at Jack,
unable to look at Becca. Finally, he pulled his gaze to hers.
I came to tell you I had feelings for you. I thought you felt the same way. That's what you said the other night.
Brad shook his head and let out a forced laugh.
I came to tell you I'm in love with you. But what? You're running around behind my back with Jack?
He looked back to Jack.
I thought your mom would kill you if you weren't home for Christmas.
We just planned this a few weeks ago, Brad, Becca said. Brad's eyes were squinted as he pieced things together.
Are you guys together or something?
Brad asked. Becca nodded, with no expression on her face. Since summer, she said. But it wasn't all of a sudden, Brad. We had feelings for each other for a while. Brad shook his head.
So all the talks we had, about my father and all his shit, all the times we stayed up until sunrise, during all that you were with Jack? Thinking about Jack?
Thinking about... No, Becca said. I was thinking about you and your situation, because we're friends, Brad. You and I have always stayed up late talking about things. That's what you and I have always done. You're a great listener and one of my best friends.
I'm going to head inside, let you guys talk, Jack said. Why didn't you tell me the other day at lunch?
Brad asked. Jack let out a long breath.
I don't know, Brad. I was shocked to hear what you were telling me. The same way you would have been shocked had I told you. So you let me go on like a fool, telling you how I thought Becca and I were going to get together. And you were fine letting me spend all Christmas break thinking I had a chance with her. Trying to figure out a way to tell her how I feel. The whole time, you knew you were going to be with her over break, laughing at me? No one's laughing at you, Brad. I'd never do that. And the other day wasn't the right time to tell you. I had to get my thoughts straight. And you came here behind my back to get your thoughts straight? No, Jack said, with some force behind his voice. I came here to spend Christmas with Becca, because she and her family invited me. None of it was done behind your back, because before the other day, I didn't know my relationship with Becca had anything to do with you.
Okay, guys, let's take a break for a minute, Becca said.
Does Gail know?
No one knows, Becca said. We didn't know how to tell you guys. Brad slowly walked past them to the front of the house where his rental was parked. He climbed in and started the engine. Where are you going? Becca asked as she followed him.
Not here.
Come inside, Brad. Meet my parents. Spend the night so we can talk.
I already met your parents, and they probably think I'm an idiot.
He backed the rental from the driveway. Becca and Jack watched their friend drive away without saying goodbye. They were left with each other, standing in front of stilled houses decorated with Christmas lights. Chapter 16. Kelsey Castle, Summit Lake, March 10th, 2012. Day 6. The red numbers on her digital alarm clock flashed again. 4:45 a.m. Tossing for an hour now, she finally sat up in bed and slid her legs from under the covers until her bare feet touched the carpet. Her hands shook as she stared into the dark room. She sat still for several minutes, trying to control her breathing and her emotions and her mind. Finally, she buried her face in her palms and began to cry. Her mind struggled all night to find answers to why she endured a savage attack and survived, while Becca Eckersley had not. Forcing herself back to work, and then coming to Summit Lake to take on Becca's story, felt like cheating, using Becca as a way to repair her own spirit. But Kelsey didn't know a better way. Her immediate reaction in the wake of her survival had been to complain about Penn Courtney giving her a paid month off from work, and to stand ready to strike like a rattlesnake at anyone who offered her sympathy or dared to ask how she was doing. But now, having walked through the Eckersleys' home and in Becca's footsteps, Kelsey's perspective changed. She had her life. She was alive. She was healthy and healing. As she sat in her dark hotel room in a small town in the Blue Ridge Mountains, Kelsey Castle knew she was being called, if not by Becca herself, and by some higher entity, to find the answers that had eluded this town,
With a deep breath, she climbed out of bed and put on jeans and a sweater. She locked her hotel room and took the empty stairwell to the lobby. Outside, a brisk lake breeze greeted her. The wind ran up the mountains to the west and cascaded back in a circular jaunt that brought with it the smoky scent of wood-burning fireplaces. Darkness filled the sky without a hint of sunrise. Only street lamps offered a soft yellow glow at intersections. Summit Lake was peacefully quiet. Kelsey sucked in the clean mountain air as she headed down the main drag on her way to the shore. As she walked toward the corner of Maple and Tomahawk, Kelsey noticed lights above the coffee house, a startling contrast to the darkness the rest of the town hid under. She saw the drapes were open, and as she got closer, she heard a knock on the second-story window, which shot open. Ray stuck her head into the cold morning air. "What are you doing out there?" "Couldn't sleep," Kelsey said. "Get in here. I'll open the front door." A few seconds later, Ray unlocked the cafe and held the door open. Kelsey noticed she was already dressed and showered. Her eyes were young and bright, without sleep or puffiness. Her sandy hair was newly blown dry and carried a soft glow of fresh conditioner. Kelsey ran a hand over her puffy hair and licked her chapped lips as she walked into the cafe. "You look perfect, all fresh and perky. What time do you get up?" "Just before 4. The oven goes on at 4:30.
"That's insane."
"Maybe for some, but I love it," Ray said. "Come back to the kitchen. I've got to pull the scones. Coffee's on." Kelsey followed Ray past the long mahogany bar and through the opening next to the register. She walked into the kitchen where Ray motioned for her to help herself to the stainless steel coffee pot on the counter. As she poured two mugs, she saw Ray don a red apron and pull a tray of scones from the oven. It was just before 5 a.m., and Kelsey watched Ray move around the kitchen as if it were noon.
"I take a little cream," Ray said, "and lots of sugar."
Kelsey prepared the coffee, then placed the cup on the island where Ray was running icing over the scones.
"Smells good," Kelsey said.
"Doesn't it?" Ray said. Her eyes jetted to Kelsey, then back to the scones.
"I see you looking at me like I'm nuts."
"Me? No, I wasn't."
"Don't worry. I give most people that impression when they find out I get up so early and sometimes stay so late. You'd think I'd get used to it or bored with it, but I don't. Not with the smells or the work or the crowd that comes through. Lots of regulars whom I've gotten to know well, and I love talking to them."
Ray pointed the icer at Kelsey.
"That's how you know you're doing what you're meant to do, when you never get bored with it and you never want to do anything else."
"Ever thought of opening your own cafe?"
"Oh yeah, all the time. Even told Livy Houston I was thinking of becoming her competition. But the thing is, Livy doesn't want this place. She's decided to move on, so Millie, Livy's mom, offered the place to me. This year is my test run to see if I can handle the place by myself. Make sure I'm sure."
"And?"
"So far, so good. Livy never stops by anymore, and Millie's too old to do much around here, so I already feel like the place is mine."
Ray finished the scones and put them to the side to cool. She threw a second batch in the oven and started dropping bagels into an automatic slicer.
"How about you? You love your job?"
Kelsey thought for a minute.
"Yeah, I do. Can't imagine doing anything else."
"Don't you feel sad for people who hate their jobs? I mean, to wake up each day and do something you don't like is no way to live. It's poor parenting, I think. When you're a kid, you don't know what you want. No 10-year-old kid dreams of being an accountant. No little girl wants to grow up to be a sales rep, right? And those are fine jobs, and lots of people are happy doing them all their life. But if no one tells you when you're a kid to dream, then you just go through life and do the things everyone else does. Sometimes the things your parents do."
Ray grabbed her coffee and took a sip.
"I don't know. I'm too philosophical in the morning. But you know what I'm saying? Do what you love to do. And if you end up not loving it, do something else."
Kelsey smiled at the girl's enthusiasm.
"I know exactly what you're saying. And it's good advice. I don't think you're too anything this morning, except happy with your life."
"Maybe a little too amped up on caffeine at 5 a.m., but there's nothing wrong with that."
Ray laughed. "I think you and I are going to get along."
"So,
Why can't you sleep?
Kelsey looked at the ceiling.
Why can't I sleep? She said to herself, mulling the question.
You have a few hours?
Oh, Ray said, nodding her head. Sounds like boy issues.
Kelsey raised her eyebrows. Hardly.
I heard there was a doctor at the hospital who was helping you with research or something.
Really?
Where did you hear this?
Ray shrugged her shoulders.
I also heard he's nice looking.
What are you talking about?
Kelsey was laughing now. He's twice my age.
That's not true. I heard he's like 40, maybe 45.
How old are you?
30.
Twice your age is 60, so stop exaggerating and avoiding the question. Is he good looking?
Where are you getting your information?
Ray smiled. I run the only coffee shop in a very small town where everyone is talking about Becca Eckersley's death. And everyone knows there's a journalist from Events magazine poking around. People talk. And in this town, those people usually talk to me. So if you're trying to keep a secret while you're here, you won't be able to.
Unless you murder a young law student. Then you can disappear into the night.
Ray puckered her lower lip. Touché. But my point is that if you don't want me to know you're hanging out with a good-looking doctor, don't have dinner with him a block away from here.
He helped me with some medical records I was looking for.
Really? Ray said. And that's it. Nothing more to the story?
What do you mean?
When I find you wandering the streets before sunrise, I assume a boy is the reason.
Kelsey smiled. I assure you, Peter Ambrose is not keeping me up at night. We just met.
Oh, Ray said with wide eyes. Then that's called pre-romantic boy issues, and they can be more complicated than full-on in-the-trenches romantic boy problems. She dropped the last bagel into the slicer and pointed to the oven where another batch of scones was baking.
Those will take about 40 minutes. Let's head up front.
Still before sunrise, the corner lamppost spilled through the windows and cast quiet shadows across the cafe. Ray clicked on a standing lamp next to the fireplace, washing the leather chairs in warm auburn light. She put logs into the fireplace and placed a match below them. As she and Kelsey settled into the chairs, the logs resisted the flames with loud cracking noises.
So if it's not a boy, then what's the reason you can't sleep? Ray asked.
I guess you could say Becca Eckersley is keeping me up at night.
Really? That's creepy.
It's the way I am. Once I get hooked on a case, it's all I can think about. And the things I'm learning about this case have my mind going 100 miles an hour.
Kelsey paused.
And I can't stop.
Stop what?
I don't know. Thinking about life and death and how it can all be taken from us so quickly.
Yeah?
Ray stared at her, reading the expression on Kelsey's face.
This case got you thinking of all that?
It did.
Dish.
What's that?
Dish, tell me what's going on with you.
Kelsey made a funny face.
Stop it, Ray said. I've read everything you've ever written, your book, twice, and all your articles, which include many homicides. You wrote about a missing 6-year-old last year, which ended very badly. And you wrote about the nut job down there in Florida who made her kid sniff chloroform and accidentally OD'd her, then buried her a mile from her home. So don't tell me you can't handle coming to a small town and writing about the death of a law student. I don't buy it. So what's up? Why are you so bothered by this?
Kelsey sipped her coffee. It was strange how people knew her so well through her writings.
Ever thought about being a shrink?
Never. Now dish. Kelsey wasn't sure why she wanted to tell this girl about the things that were bothering her, or why, after barely knowing her, she felt she could confide in Ray. She couldn't explain the reason she was about to tell this girl something she had refused to talk to the psychologist about, but there was something about Ray, a charisma that broke through to Kelsey, made her feel comfortable. She took a deep breath.
I walked through the Stilt house yesterday.
Ray pointed out the window toward the lake.
The Eckersleys?
Yeah.
I thought it was off limits.
It is, but the police chief let me take a look, pulled the tape for a few minutes.
How'd you manage that?
Kelsey shrugged. He's frustrated with the state guys taking over. He doesn't like the direction they're moving the investigation in, so I'm sort of his private way to get things done correctly.
Yeah? What did you find?
I don't know. Nothing, I guess. But I stood where Becca stood, walked in the footsteps of a girl who was raped and then murdered, and it got me thinking that the same thing damn near happened to me.
Ray slowly lifted her chin. She didn't need to ask another question or push any harder.
Kelsey exhaled a long, shaky breath. This assignment was meant to get me out of the office and back on my feet after some time off. Time off I was forced to take after I was, you know, assaulted. Same as Becca.
Jesus, Kelsey. When?
A few weeks ago.
What happened?
Kelsey's eyes were glassy with tears, but she refused to let them spill down her cheeks. I was jogging one morning, on the same path I've taken 1,000 times before, had my headphones in, and was in my own little endorphin world. He came from the woods. A straight grab and drag, the kind I've written about before, but I was suddenly living it myself. I was startled at first, didn't know what was happening. When I finally figured it all out, it was too late. I fought for my life. Woke up in the hospital a day later.
Ray just stared at her for a minute. I don't know what to say.
I'm usually blunt and direct, but I didn't mean to.
You don't have to tell me anymore.
No, no, you didn't pull it out of me. The truth is, I need to talk about it. Haven't actually talked with anyone about it, including the shrink they set me up with.
Kelsey forced a smile.
You should feel honored, Ray. This is a coffeehouse confession of epic proportions for me.
Ray smiled. I'm glad you've got a good attitude.
The other choice is to let it control me, and I'm determined not to.
They catch the guy?
Kelsey shook her head. He wore a mask. Couldn't ID him.
There was silence for a minute.
How are you? Ray finally asked. I'm moving on, putting myself back together. And I was doing a hell of a job at it, I really was. Until I walked into that house yesterday. And it made it all so real and close.
Kelsey looked into the fire. The same thing could have happened to me.
And someone else might be writing about my death.
Yeah, but it didn't.
No, it didn't. But why not? Why Becca and not me? That question is why I can't sleep. And I realized in the middle of the night that I've got to find a way to help this girl. I've got to get some closure for her.
Sounds like a good way to help yourself, too.
Kelsey shrugged and took a sip of coffee.
Probably.
There was a knock on the front door, and Kelsey saw a couple standing on the sidewalk.
Damn, Ray said, looking at the wall clock. 6 o'clock comes early. Gotta open this place and get those scones out of the oven.
Sorry to keep you.
You didn't keep me from anything. Thanks for the company this morning, and for trusting me with your story. Keep fighting, Kelsey. You're a tough girl, I can tell.
Kelsey smiled and headed for the door. I'll unlock the front. Don't let those scones burn.
Thanks, Ray said. And Kelsey, come back and visit sometime. I want to hear more, or anything you feel like telling me.
I will.
I might even be able to help you with the Eckersley case.
Oh yeah? How's that?
You know the gossip group? The busybodies who sit at the bar from the other morning?
Kelsey nodded, remembering the coffeehouse debate that took place at the bar.
Rumor has it she kept a journal.
Kelsey stopped walking and turned.
Ray smiled. I'll do some snooping and see what I come up with.
Give me a day or so. She disappeared into the kitchen. Kelsey unlocked the front door and let the couple into the cafe, then walked down Tomahawk Drive toward the lake to watch the sunrise.